Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for remaining here for this last haul of a very long day. I'm very grateful to see this many people. And I want to thank the organizers of this extraordinary conference for inviting me. We've learned quite a lot today, and I'm happy that things are going well. My paper rethinks African art history by evaluating how the photo archive and text of Karl Einstein's Megaplastic invented a problematic canon of African art that persists to this day. Megaplastic played an important role in the global reception of African art by bringing it into ongoing conversations about significant form and luminous imagery in the context of modernism. As Zoe Strother notes, Einstein literally conjured up the category African art through the systematic presentation of a doctored and highly selective group of images. However, most of the sculptures illustrated in the publication were actually products of the colonial encounter, which rather than representing a timeless Africa, testified to the vitality of contemporary African art at the turn of the century. I frame a reading of Megaplastic against analysis of the Yoruba artist Olowe Ofise, 1873 to 1938, to show how Einstein failed to account for changing African protocols of visual representation in that era. Two caveats. It is problematic to argue against a text on the basis of what was not included. That is always a very difficult thing to do. Among my people, we say, you can say this is what somebody said, not this is what they were going to say. So in that regard, I want to make it very clear that my primary aim here is to try and understand how the typology that Einstein created for African art has continued to impact the field right up to the present time. Also, in this presentation, I am not trying to posit a link between Olowe and Einstein, because there is none, as far as I know. The tragedy of colonial archives is not in what they contain, a lot of which are odious. It is what they leave out, the absences that erase and efface their entanglements with Africans. The idea is to read Olowe tangentially against the formulations of Megaplastic. I argue that the transformation in Olowe's work, what I define as the emergent modernization, is what contradicts Einstein's construct of an African art that he reframed in new and problematic forms. So, inventing African art. In the early 20th century, African art became an important point of reference for European modernists who used the architectonic logic of African masks and sculptures to transform the representational strategies of modern art. Pablo Picasso's encounter with African art at the Trocadero Museum of Ethnology, which is now the Musée de l'Homme, in Paris in 1907, is usually narrated as the or moment of modern art's entanglement with African art, or what was then called primitive art. Patricia Lighton argues that this narrative legitimizes a romantic view of Africa held by Picasso and other Parisian avant-garde, and minimizes the fact that Africans and African art itself had been visible in Paris since the 1890s. Karl Einstein's seminal publication, Megaplastic, instrumentally made the argument for the plastic qualities of African art as art. In his opening passages, he criticized the slight and imprecise knowledge of African art in Europe and the tendency to deny it is art at all. Einstein hoped the ethnocentrism of European reception of African art would be mitigated by Megaplastic's theoretical exploration of sculpturality as a model of object experience in modernity. Einstein recognized the importance of photography to redefining cultural objects, and his ensemble of images of African sculpture set the template for how such works would be presented henceforth. Megaplastic was published with 119 black and white photographs illustrating 94 different sculptures from roughly 20 countries. It is worth dwelling on how these artworks were presented in Einstein's book. The photographs in Megaplastic invited poetic reverie through a variety of techniques: soft focus floating objects in space with only occasional whispers of shadow, and spotlighting to heighten the sheen of patina. That's Zoe Strother's description of this. And Strother goes on to say, 80% of the objects are presented from a single view, frontal or three quarters. The works were usually presented full figure from a consistent vantage point. Frequently, skilled lighting interprets the sculpture as an interlocking series of planes. The emotional tenor is cool and cerebral, and with few exceptions, the objects have been stripped down to the wood carving. Achieving such presentation meant extracting the blades and clothing from objects such as Nkisi Nkondi, removing the hats and raffia ruffs from masks and toning down brightly colored paints. Through this process, Einstein hoped his analysis of these artworks would bracket out, and I'm quoting him now, would bracket out subject matter and the contextual associations related to it, and instead analyze these objects as formal constructs. We should note that Einstein sourced African sculptures from French collectors who might have been responsible for stripping them of extraneous accoutrements. However, his pursuit of formal purity suggests he was complicit in this transformation, which structured an interpretation of Africana that persists to this day, despite the very selective nature of negaplastic's focus. The publication essentially defined a canon of African art displayed in museums through wooden carvings overwhelmingly sourced from French and Belgian colonies. Despite this limitation, images from the book were eagerly adopted by scores of artists and the whole spectrum of European primitivism, from German expressionism to French post-cubic black deco. There is no information, at least no credible information, about who was responsible for the photographs Einstein included in his book. Jean-Louis Podra argues that the art dealer Joseph Brumer may have provided most of these images and also financed the book's publication. Strother notes that European artists consumed the glossy photographs of Negaplastic, but its text did not fare as well. Most of these artists did not read German, and those who did criticized the text for posting a unified theory of African sculptural production, mainly from artworks representing only West African, mostly West African cultures. However, Einstein's creation of a homogeneous archive of images, skillfully sequenced for purposes of comparison and contrast, constitutes the founding act of African art history. Inventing modernity in Yoruba indigenous aesthetics. The transformation of European modern art through the architectonic logic of African art was reflected in an equal transformation of African art by its engagement with new forms and protocols of art making engendered by European colonization. We can track such changes by reflecting on the career of Olowe Ofishe. We can track such changes by reflecting on the career of acclaimed Yoruba sculptor Olowe Ofishe, whose sculptures already mapped a divergent path for African art in the early 20th century. Colonial culture wrought great transformations in African art, especially in the forms and contents of indigenous artwork. However, a bias for identifying all indigenous artworks that emerged from the colonial era as enduring and timeless examples of African culture has led to major errors in identification and classification. Negaplastic criticized the persistent European idea that African artworks emerge from an enduring and timeless past, what he defined as a prejudicial perception of Africans as people of an eternal prehistory. But he did not pursue the implications of his criticism. However, the changing aesthetics and iconography of indigenous art resulting from the colonial encounter suggest African art had always been a dynamic context that constantly adapted to new social, political, and environmental conditions. What happened was that the early anthropologists who went to Africa caught artworks in the middle of this transformation and then fixed them as timeless examples of a very broad range of times. Einstein noted this fact when he stated that his short study of African art cannot disregard the experience of more recent art, especially since what is effective in history is always a consequence of the immediate present, and that's a quote from him. It is thought important to stress that, like the examples used to illustrate Einstein's book, most of the African artworks classified in museums as pre-colonial or traditional art were actually created during the colonial period, and their creators considered them examples of an emergent modernity captured in indigenous idioms and visual languages. As John Picton observed, Most traditional African art in museums today was made and subsequently taken abroad during the height of the colonial period, from roughly 1880 to 1960. In spite of this fact, they are wrongly and constantly described in the literature as evidence of pre-colonial African creativity. Although Officiel produced many sculptures under royal patronage at the turn of the 20th century, and these are examples of his works, Rosalind Walker's influential biography of the artist shows Olowe worked almost exclusively for various Yoruba royalty and aristocrats within a 60-mile radius of his hometown of Ise. However, he came to global attention when a set of his doors, this one on the right here, when a set of his doors for the Palace of the Ogoga of Ikere was exhibited at the 1924 British Empire Exhibition in London, and was thereafter acquired for the British Museum's collection in 1925. The image here shows the artwork in situ, gathered by two colonial auxiliary police, and you know, embedded within a facade of what was considered a traditional African house. You should note in this regard the British Museum's reconfiguration of African art in this collection as early as the date of this purchase in 1925. The mock palace facade that Olowe's doors were placed in is an example of Hausa Ginuwa architecture, mostly found in northern Nigeria, at least 1,000 miles away from Olowe's location. The museum was obviously not interested in veracity. Ginuwa architecture is very impressive. It's one of the most impressive systems of adobe architecture anywhere in the world. So, you know, this is at a world fair, so things sort of always got mixed up in these kinds of contexts. Olowe is credited with creating several important innovations in Yoruba sculpture. And to understand what this means, you have to know that Yoruba are one of the most significant art-producing cultures on the planet. In any serious collection of African art that is, you know, focused mainly on, say, West and Central Africa, Yoruba artworks will occupy quite a very substantial number of what they have in the collection. This art is very old. We have examples of bronze works, you know, naturalistic bronze works from Yoruba culture, dating back to the 12th century AD. You know, there are claims of even much older pieces. So to understand what Olowe was working with here, he was working within a tradition that already had centuries of very classical modes of representation, almost Egyptianate, you know, in their devotion to full frontality and a certain kind of hierarchical structural form. Olowe is credited with creating several important innovations in Yoruba sculpture. He imparted a suggestion of movement to his figures, thus deviating considerably from the hierarchical rigid frontality of classical Yoruba sculpture. He also developed the technique of carving the surfaces of his door in very high relief, with the figures protruding almost 6 inches from the door surface, which is considerably animated by the shadows they throw on it. And you can see a side view of one of those doors there to see that protrusion. What's interesting about that technique is that it was actually used for a very long time in Benin bronze plaques, which date from the 15th century. And this issue of images protruding very seriously from the pictorial surface or the sculptural surface was one of the key elements that made Benin art very well respected when it first started showing up in Europe. The degree of craftsmanship needed for casting those kinds of bronzes was astronomical. Olowe did the same thing with this door, and when you consider that he's carving wood, any mistake in this kind of process, you know, means you have to remove the subject. If you notice the pictorial form on his sculptures, you will know that he was paying a huge amount of attention to creating, you know, very specific kinds of narratives. Based on the evidence of his surviving sculptures, Olowe painted some of his major artworks with an expanded palette of commercial colors and may have helped popularize polychrome sculptures in Yoruba art beyond the traditional practice of coloring sculptures with subdued earth-toned pigments. He also, you know, these are two examples. This particular example was painted a bright green and yellow, and these works were done in the 1920s and 1910s. The colors have faded considerably. He also invented new forms, mainly reflected in his practice of carving a floating head within his sculptures, which became a notable facet of his work. So In this sculpture here, this is a Yoruba caryatid used by diviners to store divination ritual objects. If you look at the bottom of the sculpture there, you can see a head in the middle of that sculpture. That head is carved within the sculpture. It's not inserted into the sculpture. It's carved within it, and it's free-floating so that it rolls around when you move the pot. The top image, you know, shows this classical style of carving several figures, you know, linked up together. And if you understand carving systems in African art, Africans carve with an arts, which means, you know, this is a very highly technical and skilled sculptor. There are several examples of this kind of process in Olowe's work, and it almost always includes this floating head. It became a kind of signature that was the accurate pointer of, you know, his identity as an artist. There have been many people who try to copy his work, but most people have not done this very successfully. And that's a third example there. Susan Blier notes that changing contexts of power reflected in the subordination of African royal authority to British rule led local rulers to use visual arts to compensate for their diminished authority. Olowe's artwork contained witty references to the emergent colonial order in the furniture and entourage of Yoruba kings he depicted. Olowe has been praised for his mastery of classical Yoruba sculptural forms, but there is less commentary on his clear experiments with modernist techniques of representation, including his use, we might call this modernizing instead of modernist to not create any kind of confusion, including his use of commercial pigments and the high relief his sculptures are known for. An Olowe door from the palace at Ilawe Ekiti shows, and that's the image I had up here earlier, and that's that door over there, shows a king on a ceremonial outing accompanied by an entourage of potters and his wives. The door is divided into several registers, and the figures are carved in high relief, with many of them almost three-dimensional, a technique notable in Olowe's doors, but largely absent from comparable Yoruba carvings of that era. Olowe shows the king sitting in an imported folding chair, the third register from both bottom and top. You know, that's the king on the right. Sitting in an imported folding chair, which was a common item used by colonial officers of that era as they traveled around the country on administrative duties. Also, one register of the door shows the king mounted on a horse whose halter is decorated with beadwork. The complex beadwork found in Yoruba art today includes historical examples that used indigenously produced beads. The Yoruba city of Ife was a notable bead-producing center in the first millennium, centuries before the arrival of Europeans in West Africa. Glass from Ife has been recognized as a unique form of glass making, and this practice dates almost to 300 AD. It's now called Ife glass as an identifier in archaeological literature. But also, you know, historical examples that use indigenously produced beads, but also modern industrial beads. The adoption of imported industrial beads of uniform sizes significantly expanded beadworking in Yoruba culture, and representations of beadworking all over are thus speaks to the wealth of imagery and technique made possible by the availability of industrially produced beads, which in turn speaks to the impact of an emergent colonial economy of modernity. Olowe's imagery therefore documented African kings and their European colonizers as both jostled for power and authority within the colonial order. His famous doors, you know, that were exhibited in London showed the colonial government's subversion of indigenous authority through its representation of potters carrying a European visitor in a palanquin. These were brightly painted with imported commercially produced paint, which showed his awareness of new materials and methods. And again, to return to this earlier image, that is examples of Olowe sculptures in their actual context of use. They were designed as caryatids, you know, that supported rooftops. At the Palace of the Ogoga, there were about 12 of these sculptures, you know, holding up various roofs in different environments. The significant increase in patronage and commissions that Olowe and other sculptors of this era enjoyed was in part due to colonial economics and the new forms of wealth it made possible. which enabled innovative practices that the artists themselves considered modern approaches to representation. These artists engaged the emerging modernity of their societies and cast a keen eye on local and foreign elements that impacted their modes of visual representation. They also incorporated representations of European colonizers into their visual landscape to indicate colonial transformations of the social order. So in that sense, this conference's description of the turmoil and transformations going on in Europe were being mirrored, you know, precisely in African contexts where things were literally upended. In Europe, at least, the people that were, you know, the artists affected and the writers and creative practitioners affected by this turmoil were working within, you know, traditions that they could rebel against but was fairly, you know, notable in terms of its longevity and historicity. In Africa, whole, you know, traditions that in some cases were centuries old were turned upside down, you know, in one fell swoop of colonial domination. My grandfather was in Benin when the British invaded the kingdom in 1897, destroyed the kingdom, burned the palace, and made away with almost 9,000 artworks that now later museums, the Musée de Vaucouleurs here has quite a very nice collection. And up till when he passed away in 1986, if you asked him what happened on that day, he said the world came to an end, and that was all he would say about it. This was a culture that had ambassadors in Portugal in 1500 and, you know, was very much central to the emergence of the contemporary global order as we understand it today. In essence, we could think about the identification of Olowe as a Yoruba artist as an overly determined focus on ethnic identity that prevents us from equally seeing him as a modern artist exploring the contours of an emerging global modernity, someone suited for inclusion in the expansive notions of world art prevalent in Einstein's era. Ideally, our looking for Olowe in negaplastic. Our argument here is that Einstein produces analysis of African art through a very limited corpus comprising mostly cultural objects sourced from Francophone Africa. In doing so, he established a protocol that still frames museumized and discursive representations of African art. Olowe, on the other hand, operated within Anglophone Africa, which describes regions colonized by Britain rather than France. One could suggest, therefore, that Einstein was unaware of Olowe in this regard, but this would not rescue the book from its disregard of important publications of that era that were reshaping European understanding of African cultural capabilities. Negaplastic's sumptuous photographic presentation of African sculpture was predated by the Musée du Congo's 1906 tome, Notes, Analytics, Sule Collections, Ethnographics, which contained almost 700 photographs published alongside some contextual field photos. In his publication, in this publication, each sculpture was fully and evenly lit and submitted to the rigor of full formal and full frontal and full profile comparisons reproduced with the highest resolution. Leo Frobenius's Und Afrika Sprach was an equally influential publication of the period, even though its conclusions were very disturbing. Published in 1912 to rapturous reviews, the book's account of historical objects and antiquities from places such as the Yoruba Kingdom of Ife established without doubt that Africa had both a history and an art history, and that both were changing very significantly. Und Afrika Sprach used a combination of photographs and illustrations drawn by Carl Ariens, who accompanied the expedition, to illustrate the complex art Frobenius encountered in his journey through Africa. Zoe Stodder notes that Einstein was certainly aware of Frobenius's work by the time of Negaplastic, absorbing some of his lessons while ignoring his revelations about transformations in Yoruba art and religion. And that kind of transformation you can see here in this, well, let me just leave that to speak for itself. Even if Einstein was unaware of important transformations in the forms and visuality of indigenous art in Anglophone Africa, the Benin sculpture illustrated on page 61 of his book proves otherwise. His framing of African art occurred within the same discursive space as that of the German George Schweinfurt, 1836 to 1925, whose visit to and depictions of Mangbetu culture, published in Germany in 1871, became for Western and Mangbetu artists a catalyst that spawned a wave of new aesthetics in Mangbetu art, performance, and architecture. Negaplastic's reliance on photography to frame his ensemble of African art raises two important questions. The first concerns the unstable relationship between photographic imagery and representation. The alluring photographic image is a mode of representation that effectively translates African cultural registers into a Eurocentric visual language before they can emerge as subjects of discourse. It raises the question of whether the artwork presented in an alluring image is the same as the cultural object photographed. These are photographs of two objects, one by a professional photographer, the other one by me. I sent this to various colleagues. Everyone said this one was fake and that one was authentic. John Baudrillard knows that the photographic image is not a representation. It's a fiction. The fictional status of Negaplastic's photographic image is clearly enunciated in the protocol described above, where sculptures were stripped down to their pure form as wooden objects, denuded of all ancillary forms attached to the original cultural artifact. I have contended elsewhere and reiterate here that the photographic image produces a new cultural object that is related to the original African artwork only by association, since both differ in appearance in significant ways. We could then rightly ask whether an Nkisi Nkondi, this object that we see here, denuded of the nails that both activate the sculpture and serve as an archive of its interventions, is still an Nkisi. Considering that the pure form of its wooden armature, the humanoid figure that stands of ground for its temporal transformation, is an initial step towards the iconic form of the object, one can charge Negaplastic with iconoclasm in its reconfiguration of these African artworks. The second issue concerns the The second issue concerns the temporality of the artworks as they are presented in Negaplastic. Though Einstein criticized the European perceptions of Africans as atemporal, his framing of African artworks fall prey to what Johannes Fabian Stem's allochrony, the practice of denying the other a shared coeval contemporaneity. In seeking a formal purity for the artworks and representing them devoid of contextual matter, Negaplastic constructed a new category of objects that it subsequently reframed as African art. The atemporality that results not only posed a timeless past to African artworks, it prevented Einstein from grappling with the emergent newness of modern interpretations of archaic indigenous forms. And like Olowe's artworks, the irony here, you know, is that most of the sculptures in Negaplastic were not as old as Einstein imagined. Conclusion. Olowe's modernity exists in the slippage between Einstein's fetishization of pure form and the crisis of modernity, which was reflected as a process of global transformations rather than a solely European engagement. Einstein himself recognized that his study of African art cannot disregard, you know, the experience of more recent art. And it was important that, you know, one might ask why he did not recognize that the crisis in modernism was keenly felt in an Africa under colonial rule, where established protocols of indigenous life were overturned and replaced by new protocols imposed by fiat. The loss of social cohesion, the isolation of the individual, and the atomization of society, as this conference describes it, that circumscribes despair in Europe in the early 20th century, were equally significant issues that engaged African peoples and artists. Olowe confronted these issues by producing sculptures that were radically different from the iconic forms of classical Yoruba sculpture. All forms of African art were undergoing similar transformations, and the artworks and cultural objects documented by early anthropologists in Africa were usually caught in the throes of such transformations and were in many cases quite new and contemporary. Olowe's experiments will lead to radical revisioning of Yoruba sculpture as its tenets and visual languages were applied to new objects, such as Christian liturgical imagery in Oyo-Ekiti workshops a few decades later. Einstein deserves praise for Negaplastic, since it represented his personal effort to contest what he termed the West's superficial, slight, and imprecise knowledge about art from Africa. The book generated fame and opportunities for the author, who in 1960 subsequently secured an appointment with the colonial government in Brussels. Provided access to major libraries and collections of African art, his next book, Africanish Plastic, was well-researched and up-to-date on contemporary scholarship of that period about African art. Again, its conclusions might be questionable. I argue that Olowe similarly deserves praise for his efforts to modernize classical Yoruba sculpture. The fact that Negaplastic overlooks such effort means that its effort to historicize African art was visually and conceptually flawed. However, it achieved Einstein's intention to bring an historical sequence for African art into being. And in this, it remains a very important and credible work. Thank you.